When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
And this is actually a really important line, because your right to believe is absolute. It's probably the only absolute right you have under our Constitution. But your right to act on that belief is not. So I actually opened the book with several stories about drivers letting Jesus take the wheel, right? Now, they right. are free to believe that their personal savior is a backseat driver and that he is stepping in and grabbing the wheel. Fine. But if they actually act on that, the civil law can also step in and say no.
Hi, I'm Chloe Guillo, and you're listening to On God's Campus, Voices from the Queer Underground, a podcast about white Christian supremacy and being queer on the most conservative campuses in the country. Think of me as your guide and translator as we explore the carefully constructed subculture of religious education. Joining me are co-hosts Paul Carlo Southwick, our resident legal expert and historian, and Aaron Green, our biblical scholar. What you will find here is a roadmap to change from the underbelly of the church's best-kept secrets.
All right. We've got an amazing guest today, Andrew Seidel. Thanks for being with us, Andrew. And Andrew is Vice President of Strategic Communications for Americans United for Separation of Church and State. He's also an attorney, like me, who has defended the First Amendment for more than a decade, and is the author of two books, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American, and American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. Which just came out last year, and which he kindly signed for me at the Summit for Religious Freedom in April, where we were all there in D.C. this past April. So thanks so much for being here, Andrew. And Aaron's got a little bit more on you.
That's my pleasure.
Andrew is a senior correspondent at Religion Dispatches, and he organized and contributed to the groundbreaking report, Christian Nationalism at the January 6, 2021 Insurrection, which was published by the Baptist Joint Committee and the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Andrew graduated from Tulane University and Tulane University Law School. And Andrew was also an environmental lawyer and Grand Canyon tour guide, which I have questions about.
Oh, we could talk about that for a long time.
In a previous life, okay. Welcome to On God's Campus, Andrew. We're so excited to have you here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for hosting me.
Hey, well, I'll just kind of jump right out to it. We have spent some time in your latest book, American Crusade. So just kind of from the outset, could you tell our listeners why you wrote American Crusade and how it might be relevant to some of the religious liberty, civil rights, and education battles that we see erupting throughout the country?
Absolutely. So to all the Christian nationalists out there in America, we're not coming for your rights. We're coming for your privilege. That's nice. How I dedicated American Crusade.
That's a great dedication.
We love Court to is, see it.
I would love to see it. And the subtitle is How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. And you know, I this is something I really wanted to wake the country up to. There is a crusade to weaponize religious freedom. The title kind of says it all. You know, thanks to the packed, captured Supreme Court, religious freedom has really become a tool, a weapon of Christian privilege, of Christian supremacy. Religious freedom is meant to protect everybody who is listening to this podcast, whether you are a blasphemous, godless heathen, atheist yikes, like myself.
Yikes!
it's getting hot in here.
That, just to be clear, that's me, right? Or you know,
it's a little bit us too.
Maybe just
or
a tad.
Whether you're at church three times a week, you know, religious freedom includes the right to worship any god, every god, or reject every god. And in other words, it's long been this shield, right? It's a hallowed protection against government overreach. It's the minority's protection against the tyranny of the majority, and it's a right that is guaranteed by a strong separation of church and state. But not anymore. Not anymore. And there is a well-funded, powerful network of Christian nationalist organizations and judges. This is a billion-dollar shadow network that has been working to turn that protection of religious freedom enjoyed by all into a weapon of supremacy and privilege for the few. I mean, they really are waging a crusade to weaponize religious freedom. And I think it's important to recognize that this is a war of conquest. It's not of land. But the Crusaders they're looking to conquer the Constitution and remake it in their image.
I remember, learning a lot about Crusaders, and, you know, you think of the shield and the armor and the sword. Mm-hmm. What do American Crusaders nowadays, what do they look like? How do we spot them?
If you saw any of the footage from January 6th, you saw the foot soldiers.
Okay.
yep. In this crusade. Yep.
A little bit of a ragtag band in some ways.
Quite impressive. Band.
Quite impressive, yes. But they also have, I mean, the Christian nationalist organization in this country that is really backing this crusade, it's a top-down organization. And so you have these huge sources of funding, these sort of prime movers on the other side, people like Leonard Leo, who is kind of universally recognized as the guy who orchestrated the hostile takeover of our courts. And then you have these Christian nationalist organizations, these groups that all have kind of the similar names, these legal groups that make up the billion-dollar shadow network, like Alliance Defending Freedom and the American Center for Law and Justice and the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty and Liberty Council and First Liberty Institute. I mean, really, like this Orwellian word salad, right?
right.
And they're the ones who are filing lawsuit after lawsuit. They're stoking these fears of status loss. They're setting the cases up so that their friends on the Supreme Court can come.
And we come across them all the time in the work that we do.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
From my side of things, when I think of American Crusader like that, I think suit and tie, Ivy degree Ivy degree school, and people who are wicked smart and have lots of money. Very different than the insurrectionist ragtag crew, and probably a lot more dangerous. I don't know. What do you think?
I do. No, absolutely agree. And the I think the commonalities are the anti-democracy bent of both. I do think that the billionaire like Leonard Leo, who worked at Brooks Brothers, right, is like, you know, really into his fashionable suits more so than
for
maybe.
Real. Is that a fact?
Yeah. He's like very much into the sartorial. He is not a man to shy away from a very expensive suit. And, you know, he got a $1.6 billion donation last summer for his anti-democracy.
Wow. I used to work at Brooks Brothers as well.
No, you didn't.
I did in a previous life before I was a cool religious activist helping queer and trans students at religious colleges. But yes, in a former life.
Did you know Leonard Leo? Did you work with him?
I did not, unfortunately, have that privilege.
But I mean, you know, it's crazy too, because I also think that we can say maybe not just suits, but also I think now it's fair to say that we're talking about some of these crusaders in robes too. You know, I mean, these groups and these high level crusaders are filing lawsuit after lawsuit, but they're setting them up for the justices on the Supreme Court to come knock them down, right? And it begins, honestly, to look a lot like, to use the C word that was popular a while back, it begins to look like collusion. And especially when we find out that these same groups and these same donors are wining and dining justices on private super yachts and private jets and on island hopping vacations, none of which are disclosed. You know, the other C word for that is corruption.
Absolutely. And I think we're learning more and more. It seems like each week some kind of new article is coming out exposing these gifts and undisclosed potential conflicts and marital relationships. I think you described the American Crusaders as sort of an incestuous group. And that seems to be coming to light more and more. Do you think it's going to have an effect on how the American public sees the court, or are they just going to be able to kind of bat it away?
I mean, to me, that is one of the big questions, because I come back to, and I talk about this at the end of American Crusade quite a bit, the Supreme Court is the central roadblock, the central problem that we as a nation face right now. I mean, whatever progressive issue you care about, whether it is LGBTQ rights or abortion rights or solving the climate crisis, you know, having clean water and clean air to drink and breathe, whether you care about workers' rights or racial justice, any of those issues, the Supreme Court is the major roadblock that stands in the way of progress on those. We saw it time and time again this term, and it also stands, I think, athwart democracy. So the question that I have is, we know this court has been packed. We know this court has been captured already. The question that I have is, what are we going to do about it? And we have all these great policy solutions like, hey, you know what? The Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. We'll pass the Women's Health Protection Act, and that will fix a lot of the problems that underlied Roe in the first place, and it'll basically undo the Dobbs decision. That's great. What happens when the Women's Health Protection Act gets to the Supreme Court in a year or two?
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think we know what would likely happen to it.
Does anybody have any doubt about that? It doesn't. The facts and the law don't matter.
They did before Dobbs, and you know, now I think if you really think that they're going to defend something like that now, I think you are just, you know, hoping against hope, and not really with your eyes open.
You are. And, you know, there was a former employee of Leonard Leo's who described his mission like this. This is what he said about Leo's mission. Quote, he figured out 20 years ago that conservatives had lost the culture war. Abortion, gay rights, contraception. Conservatives didn't have a chance if public opinion prevailed. So they needed to stack the courts. Right, and that's what they did. And I mean, just notice the anti-democratic admission.
Wow.
The goal in, like, if we don't stack the courts, you guys, the majority is going to rule. Democracy is going to work. What are we going to do? Well, we'll spend $550 million packing the court from 2014 to 2020. And you don't spend that kind of money to get an impartial court. They bought a court.
Oh, and that. That's scary for all of us, you know,
super scary.
And like you said, for anyone in any kind of justice movement, it seems like we are just going to be heading back in time for a bit, which leads me into kind of a more specific question for you. One of the chapters in your book, Andrew, chapter 15, in American Crusade, is Religious Freedom and Segregation Academies. And so this is a chapter that's close to our hearts because at REAP, we focus on religiously affiliated educational institutions. And right now, there's a lot of fights over queer, trans, and non-binary rights within education, both public, private, and religious. But these are rights, these are fights that we have seen before and are getting raised in new ways as well with the anti-CRT movement and the book bans. And so, you know, a lot of people don't know that there is a racist history to the school choice movement, to private religious schools, to religious exemptions to civil rights laws, and you talk a lot about that. So what I want to ask you now is, why is it important for people to know about this racist history, even if the schools and organizations that are part of this are no longer explicitly racist in all the ways that they used to be? You know, nobody's trying to keep black kids out of schools directly and explicitly in the way that they used to. So why is it still important for us to know this history now?
I mean, I actually think it's crucial that people understand that the modern push for vouchers and for school choice wasn't born of this pure religious freedom question, right? Which is like that, that's how it is enshrined in most people's brains, and that's just wrong. It was born of racism, and then later it was sort of cloaked in this religious freedom rhetoric and shell only later on. I mean, to me, that is absolutely crucial. I think it's very hard to shake off the taint of racism, and I think it should be. I don't know that time simply passing is enough to do that. And it's especially important now when we are seeing the Supreme Court utterly eviscerate so many of the things that have moved this country away from desegregation and institutionalized racism, like gutting the Voting Rights Act in case after case. Like, okay, they didn't kill it stone dead this particular term, but they put it on life support in several previous decisions, Shelby County, Brnovich, et cetera, and then left it to die another day this term, right? They overturned affirmative action in higher education, right? Race conscious admissions.
Right. It's like an incrementalism, but it feels like an accelerated incrementalism on their side.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think the biggest one is actually the 303 creative case, which to my mind, this drives a church bus through our public accommodation laws, which arguably did perhaps the most to move this country away from towards desegregation, away from segregation, right? In places of public accommodation, certainly. But I mean, really, Sotomayor has written about this quite a bit, talked about the importance of that. But if you want, I think, to me, the seminal writing on that is Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail, which I highly recommend people reread if they have not, pay particular attention to the passage where he talks about watching the clouds of mental inferiority form in his daughter's mental sky, when he tells her that the commercial that she just saw for Funtown doesn't let colored kids in. That's how he phrased it. Those laws were one of the things that moved us towards equal citizenship, and they were very, very successful on that front.
But also controversial, right? I mean, we kind of take them for granted now, but at the time, there was massive resistance, right?
There was, and the Supreme Court stood up to it back then, including from the church. Well, I mean, some of the first arguments that were made against it were free speech and religious freedom. And the court
that sounds familiar.
Yeah, the court laughed those off in a footnote back in the 60s, but now this captured court, is deciding cases on that basis. So to answer your question, I think the reason it's so crucial that we understand the origins of modern school choice and vouchers is because we are very quickly moving back to those origins in other areas. And I do not think we should expect any different when it comes to private schools, especially private religious schools.
I kind of want to pivot to talking more about faith-based things. This is Andrew. I know you might not know a lot about me, but I'm the Bible scholar of us, of the group here.
We have a resident biblical scholar.
Yes,
love
it's
it.
True. But I'm the cool kind, so don't
gotcha.
Worry.
But I
don't have an expertise in like the law and things like that, obviously, like you and Paul do. But can you help kind of explain the context or the proper context for what religious freedom in America should look like for those of us who may not understand fully how that should be manifested in our society?
It's a great question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is such an important question, and it's one that I try to answer throughout American Crusade, because I think the answer is really simple. I do not think the questions that these cases we're seeing decided at the Supreme Court over the last 10 years, the religious freedom questions that are presented, are that hard to answer at all. In fact, I think when religion and the law collide, most of the time, the way forward is pretty basic. it's pretty easy to solve, unless of course there's some ulterior motive behind the cases and opinions, which, you know, I kind of argue there might be. Now, I think you can do this by drawing three lines, and I'll preface this by saying that one of the things I try to do in American Crusade is not hide behind legalese or civil procedure or judicial philosophies or levels of scrutiny or precedents. I think that oftentimes legal writers really love to hide behind those in the guise of appearing to have this superior knowledge. I think it's much better to shed all of that nonsense, to get back to basics, to avoid the BS.
Absolutely.
Yes, and I think when you cut through all of that prattle and piffle, the simple truth that these are easy questions is presented. And all you have to do is draw these three basic lines. Now, in the spirit of not using legalese, I creatively refer to these lines in the book as line number one, line number two, and line number three. Okay.
All right.
Ah.
Easy to follow?
Yes.
I know. Try to keep up, everybody. Okay. the first line that we draw is we distinguish between action and belief. And this is actually a really important line because your right to believe is absolute. It's probably the only absolute right you have under our Constitution. But your right to act on that belief is not. So I actually opened the book with several stories about drivers letting Jesus take the wheel. Right? Now, they right. are free to believe that their personal savior is a backseat driver and that he is stepping in and grabbing the wheel. Fine. But if they actually act on that, the civil law can also step in and say no. Right? It can fine them. It can take away their license. It can maybe even send them to prison. Right? The belief is unlimited, but the action is limited. And so that brings you to the second line, which is, okay, then if the government can step in and say no, when is it permissible for the government to do so? And the answer right. here is also pretty simple too. And it's where the rights of other people begin. Okay, now it may be in some cases that the government can step in sooner, but it absolutely can step in where the rights of other people begin. So your right to, everybody's heard this, your right to swing your fist ends at the other person's nose. Well, your right to swing your religion ends where the rights of other people begin.
Right, so if you have a religious belief, whether it's dangerous to others or not, you can have that belief and no one can punish you for it. But if your belief is not dangerous, if it's benign, then, you know, it's probably going to be tolerated. But if it's dangerous or pernicious, that's where the state can step in. Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. Here's another way to think of it. Religion is not a license to harm others or infringe their rights in any way. Yes. And it's pretty basic. I mean, you know, Crystal, as a Bible scholar, the Abraham Isaac example is like reasonably helpful here too. And it's actually one that both the Supreme Court and Thomas Jefferson have used to explain this point before, right? Abraham can believe that God is telling him that he has to kill his son. But if he tries to do that, or if he succeeds in doing that, the government can step in and say, you do not get to kill your child because you think your God right. is telling you to. Right? That's the kind of the ultimate violation of somebody else's.
Well, and it seems absurd to us sitting here talking, but when I've read your book and some of the things I know about, it's not too absurd in some communities. Yeah. They are killing their children by denying them medical care and things yeah. like that.
All kinds yeah. of things, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there are graveyards in Idaho just full of children who died because they didn't get things like antibiotics and insulin. Another.
So what's line number three?
Line number three, I think, is also easy too. It is the line between state and church, right? Our government has no religion to exercise, and government officials can't abuse government power and resources to promote their personal religion, which is a way that we don't often talk about church-state separation, but is a way that I think we should, right? These are people who are occupying a temporary office, and when they are using the powers and privileges of that office to promote or impose their personal religion on others, it's just a pure abuse of power. And so I think when you have those three basic lines, the questions posed in religious freedom cases really do become easy to answer. And that's one of the things I try to do throughout American Crusade is go back and look at these cases over the last 10 years and apply those lines and say, yeah, see, pretty basic.
So I love all that, and I love the explanation. I think it's simple to understand, and it's reasonable, right? I'm curious, though, because the churched population makes up such a big population of America, especially the progressive churches, how do you feel, or in what ways do you feel that progressive churches are helping the case for the separation of church and state, but also how are they harming it currently?
I think that's a really good question. And it's one of the reasons I love working at Americans United. So Americans United for Separation of Church and State. We're a nonpartisan, not-for-profit, educational and advocacy organization. And the thing that I really love is that we bring together people of all religions and of none to protect the right of everybody to believe as they want, but also to stop anyone from using their beliefs to harm others. And AU's been doing this for nearly 75 years. And one of the things I love about it is getting to work across all kinds of different divides and aisles with people who may not believe, as may not be the blasphemous godless heathen that I, like myself that I mentioned at the beginning, but are working to build a better America by keeping church and state separate. My friend Chrissy Stroop put this very nicely. She said that shared values matter more than shared beliefs. And yeah, she said that, and I had the exact same reaction, and it has just lodged in my brain, and I use it all the time now. And I would rather have a drink and a chat and split some guacamole with a group of Christians who value anti-racism and social justice than with a group of anti-equality atheists. But there's not many of those, but they exist and they're very loud. The capper for me, though, is that shared values matter far more when we as a nation face an existential threat like white Christian nationalism. We are at a point where we have to be reaching in and find across every divide that we can and finding those allies where they are. The report that you mentioned at the beginning, Paul, maybe it was you, I don't remember who did that part of the intro, that I worked on about the role that Christian nationalism played in the January 6th insurrection. That was basically Amanda Tyler and myself. That was the two of us working side by side. And Amanda Tyler, she is a member of the clergy. She works for the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty. But she is also a very, now I would say, dear friend. And we've done a lot of work together on this front. And historically, Baptists have been very good on church-state separation. They split as a sect, and one of the groups is maybe not as good these days. Amanda and her group do some really phenomenal work, and they also run something called Christians Against Christian Nationalism, which I think is, there's a line in the Bible about getting one's own house in order, maybe something about removing the log from your own eye. I really think that if we're going to beat back this anti-democratic movement, white Christian nationalism in the United States, it's going to require American Christians doing a lot of that work.
I agree. And, I grew up in a fundamentalist Christian home, so did. But we both came from, that sort of view of religion. But, I know religions come in many varieties and flavors. There are some that are sweet, some are more bitter, some are poisonous. It seems to me like religious fundamentalism of whatever religion or denomination is what threatens human rights and democracy in a way that non-fundamentalist religion does not. So should the law or should society treat fundamentalism sort of a different category from the rest of religion, or how should we account for that?
Gosh, the law has such a hard time figuring out what religion is. I'm trying to imagine the law trying to separate religion from religious fundamentalism or religious extremism, and the issue that the judges would have with that. And how difficult that would be for them. It's an interesting thought, though, Paul. I mean, it really is. You know, I mean, here's, I'm just, this is not quite, an, this is not an answer, but I'm going to tell you what my dream is. My dream is to live in a country where the separation of church and state is valued by everyone, where we all, from believers to the most extreme believers to non-believers, understand that true religious freedom can only exist with a secular government, that we get freedom of religion only when we have a government that is free from religion, right? Like, I want to live in a country where my nonprofit, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, is unnecessary. I'm trying to put myself out of a job where REAP is unnecessary. You know, I want a country where I can get together with people who believe vastly disparate things from me in terms of, you know, and have these deep, fascinating conversations about God and the nature of the universe and why we're all here, and then disagree about all those things. You know, but right now at this moment, we are just fighting a movement that would, I think, if given the power, make those conversations impossible, that would privilege conservative, white, heterosexual Christian men above everyone else, that would create an America with two classes, the privileged, white, conservative Christian men and everybody else, right? That where the law would protect that in-group, that privileged class, but not bind them. And where the law would bind everybody else but not protect them. That's what we're moving towards. And, you know, I do believe that our country is on fire right now. Our democracy isn't slipping away. It's being stolen. The republic is being strangled. And those of us who share values like equality and justice and truth and fairness must come together to stop the arsonist, the thief, the murderer. And that means fighting Christian nationalism. And that means, I think above all, fighting for an America where the separation of church and state is not just absolute, but valued.
I worry, though, that... So, like, that view of religious pluralism, and, you know, I think that would lead to a lot of, you know, peace in our country, a lot more peace than we're currently experiencing. But isn't that fundamentally incompatible with religious fundamentalism? You know, like, how I was raised is, this is a Christian nation, and if you believe otherwise, Andrew, you are a godless pagan heathen leading us astray and leading our country to its demise. Mm-hmm. So is there a place for fundamentalists in a pluralistic society, or are they just, do we treat them as outcasts, essentially?
Yeah, I mean, that you're, now we're into Popper's paradox of tolerance, I think, which is super fun. But it is, I mean, it is, I think, of certainly a valid question to ask. And that's one of the things that I was trying to get at the end there, where we all understand that the separation of church and state is what protects our ability to think and believe as we want, first and foremost. And you're right that there are going to be some belief systems where that are incompatible with that, that are, no, the only structure and belief structure that can exist is mine, and it has to take primacy over everything else. And then you are fully into the question of toleration and the Popper's paradox of toleration. And at what point can a society that's built on tolerance, or what point must it stop tolerating those beliefs? It's a really, really thorny question in philosophy. And I certainly haven't solved it.
Well, the court had answered this question back in the 70s and 80s when it came, to a certain extent, answered this question in the context of racism, and basically said, yeah, you know, if you have religion-based racist beliefs that are put into racist practices that harm black folks, then those are not things that we are going to protect under the Constitution. And so in this podcast, we talk a lot about Bob Jones University versus the United States. I know you talk about that in your book as well, in American Crusade, and some of the decisions there. So what? And just for our listeners who maybe didn't hear prior episodes, in Bob Jones, the court sided with equality for Black Americans against religious liberty justifications for the government's support of racist religious educational institutions. And so what the current court has done is basically said, we're not extending that to any other minority groups. We're not extending that to women, to queer folks, to trans folks. But I'm wondering, is race on the table again? So how do you think the Bob Jones University case would be decided today, now that Crusaders, as you call them, have taken over the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And I think the 303 creative opinion, which came down on June 30th, offers some insight into that answer. First, I do want to just offer a small refinement on your question, Paul, because people are still free to be racists in this country if they want.
Right.
There's a lot of things they can't do, like use their business or their limited liability company or their place of public accommodation to then harm other folks with their racist beliefs, at least for now.
Or to get government money to further those practices.
Exactly.
Right.
Bob Jones was a racist. You know, he said, I think he said, the quote is, if you are against segregation and against racial separation, then you are against God. It really did not like infidels or satanic propagandists, and really believed that, this is the quote, God Almighty turned the colored people in the South into wonderful Christian people, right? Basically, like, racism was a good thing because it made Christians, basically. I'd be interested.
Stand up character. Stand up
character, like a forerunner for today's
model
mega preachers.
Model citizen.
And he really brought that ethos and his religion into Bob Jones University. Every school activity and class started and ended with prayer. There was daily church for students that was mandatory. There was, of course, religion classes. And as part of that biblically literal Christianity, in his mind, that meant admitting only white people into Bob Jones University. And the reason I'm laying all that out is because I think he made a good case of linking his racism to his religion. I think they were very, very clear about that throughout the case.
It wasn't just sort of a Southern cultural value. It was something that they directly tied to how they interpreted the Bible.
Exactly. And, you know, they sent out this fundraising letter when the IRS first started saying, hey, you might lose your tax exemption because of this. And they, you know, the whole cause of Christ is at stake in this matter. Fear mongering and fundraising off of it, which is, you know, that's the way of the billion-dollar shadow network that I mentioned earlier. They've got deep roots here. For this court, my guess is today that you could point that. You can point to the 303 creative case, which the court just decided, and that provides sufficient precedent to overturn Bob Jones. I know we will see some lawyers arguing that at some point in the next few years. I think one thing people don't realize is that after the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, which was ADF's first challenge, the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is one of those groups I mentioned, their first challenge to a public accommodation law that reached the Supreme Court, which was on religious freedom and free speech grounds, right? They basically said, we do not have to serve LGBTQ people, even though the state civil rights law says so, because of free speech and because of religious freedom. And in that case, the court didn't decide that question. They basically punted, even though they decided against the couple, but in a punt. But we still saw a wave of discrimination in Colorado against these marginalized communities after that case came down, even though it didn't give the bigots what they wanted. And there's a study that I go over in the book that looked at these numbers, but there's also a case study where there was this wedding venue in Mississippi that said right after the case denied allowing an interracial couple to marry there, and said, we don't, our biblical, I don't remember the exact quote, but something like our biblical worldview doesn't allow us to do interracial marriages. That was at least the thrust of what they were saying. Now they backtracked, but if you go listen to the oral arguments in both the Masterpiece Cake Shop case and in the 303 creative decision, one of the constant questions that the justices and asked and that the lawyers tried to answer was, if we allow discrimination against this group, against LGBTQ people, what's to prevent it from being used against other groups that are supposed to be these protected classes? And nobody could answer that question. It basically came down to saying race is different.
Which is sort of a non-answer.
It's a non-answer.
Yeah.
And Gorsuch does the same thing in this latest opinion. He makes basically no attempt to distinguish discrimination against LGBTQ people from racial discrimination, other than to say Sotomayor's analogy to the separate but equal is, quote, pure fiction. That's basically it. But it is impossible to draw a logical or consistent line between discrimination against one protected class, race, and another, sexual orientation, because once religiously motivated discrimination is permitted, you've already drawn the line in the wrong place, right? Instead of drawing the line between night and day, the crusaders are drawing the line between these shades of benighted bigotry, is how I put it in the book. We are going to see racial discrimination be argued in the wake of this case. I would not be surprised if it ties to money and to public education too. I mean, especially with the fall of affirmative action,
right?
It certainly is. And I pulled up the quote from that wedding venue that turned away the interracial couples. We don't do gay weddings or mixed race because of our Christian race. I mean, our Christian belief. That is what they said at the time. So there you go.
Wow. Damn.
Interesting slip there.
Yeah, it was.
Oh boy. Well, I have a law question though. Okay. So how can the court interpret that way? Like if they can't answer that slippery slope question, then how can they make a decision that was so firm on, the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision or what, give any given case or whatever. Like if they're not able to answer that like slippery slope thing, how can they make decisions based on that?
Well, one thing that I looked for when the opinion came down, and I wrote an op-ed after the oral argument in April, and then I held it till we got the opinion. And the only thing I had to change in that op-ed was I had to delete a paragraph because I predicted that the majority was going to try very hard to distinguish race from the other kinds of discrimination. And I even predicted that Amy Coney Barrett was going to write a concurring opinion that did that. I was wrong about that and had to delete that line. The court did not try to do anything to distinguish race. It went out of its way to avoid any discussion of it at all. Which suggests to me that they could not do it. And they are opening this Pandora's box and hoping to figure out a way to deal with it when it actually comes up in a case. That may be too broad a reading, and I will say that I've not seen anybody else say something along those lines. So that's just Andrew talking out of his, mouth right now. But it is noticeable that the majority avoided any discussion of race, and really seemed to go out of their way to avoid that. haunting, really.
I think that is a good observation of what the court didn't say and what that might mean, because when you leave something unsaid, you're essentially leaving room for people to act in that area. So,
yeah. Paul, do you know what else the court didn't say?
What else?
The court did not, despite the fact that this was an LGBTQ case and about theoretically gay marriage, the court did not cite Obergefell or mention that marriage equality is the law of the land.
Right, because essentially there's a fundamental right that is being burdened by the 303 decision, and they don't talk about it.
Yes, which I think is also like very alarming.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, yeah. So,
well, I know that there's lots of doom and gloom, but yes. We are also in the fighting backstage, and we represent, you know, a lot of young people who are in these religious communities where their elders are basically fighting for Christian nationalism, but they are often rebelling against their elders. And so we reserve a time in each of episode of our podcast to do a question from a student question.
Oh, yes. And I love this.
Yeah, and we'll
honoring
have this,
the rebellion. I'm so excited about this.
That's right. That's right. And just kind of speak to, you know, the current generation of high school and college students as you're formulating your answer.
Over the past few years, young people have watched the Supreme Court gut many of the rights that generations before us fought to protect. And, at least for me, it feels like I'm facing the consequences of elections and decisions that happened before I was even allowed to vote, which feels disheartening. Despite that, how have you seen young people get involved in the fight against Christian nationalism? And what advice would you give to young people who want to get more involved in this fight?
Such a good question. So many thoughts are going through my head. I mean, first of all, I've been so impressed with this rising generation and their rebellion and their willingness to take on Christian nationalism. And I think that activism and the fight that they are getting involved in is one of the actually the reasons that we are seeing all this. And I'll get into that in a second. But in terms of things that you can do, I think one, arming yourself with the appropriate knowledge about what you are actually up against and arguments against it is crucial. That's one of the reasons I wrote my books. Don't buy them, go to the library and get them out. Sorry, Union Square Publishing, pretend you didn't hear them. I think everybody out there listening to this has a platform of some kind that they can use to speak out against Christian nationalism, and they should be doing that. If you want to get more involved, Americans United we put together these cohorts of youth fellows that we train to be activists all around the country, and they do this really amazing work. And I would encourage you to look up Americans United's youth fellowship programs. We also hire legal interns. We have 4 interns on our communications team, which I run this year. And of course, there are other groups out there doing great work as well, like REAP, like American Atheists, ACLU, who are all kind of on the front lines. But
and Americans United, that would be AU.org, right?
AU.org. Okay. Yes, sir. Thank you. But I do want to talk just a little bit about hope, because I do detect, you know, there's kind of a note in that question of frustration. And I think when people read American Crusade, you know, I used to tell people when they would buy the book, or when they would, like, people would contact me on social media, be like, "Hey, Andrew, I bought your book," and I would always respond like, you know, "Thank you, happy reading." Yeah, that's the right response.
Because American Crusade, that's a little bit of a misdirection.
Yeah, it's like, it's very, and I realized you know, after the 4th or 5th time I did this with anybody, I'm like, oh, I should stop saying that. But actually, I do have hope. I have a lot of hope, and a lot of it has to do with this generation. And I want to explain that because I think it's really important to leave these conversations with hope. And so, I mean, first, like, one of the important things to ask in any fight is why. And for the other side, I want to, like, why are they seeking religious freedom as a weapon? Why are they turning to Christian nationalism? You know, like Sauron in the Ring, like Voldemort in the Elder Wand, Thanos in the Infinity Stone. I'm trying to find something that connects with this generation. They are seeking a weapon of power.
Yes.
Power.
Yep.
But why are they so scared? Why? And I think a lot of it has to do with this generation, because nuns are on the rise, because Americans are leaving religion behind, because we elected our first black president and a black female vice president, because of marriage equality, because every day we are closer to racial and gender and LGBTQ equality, and because they are so used to seeing a narrow world that reflects their straight, white, conservative Christian patriarchy, that the existence, let alone the equality of anyone else, really threatens them. And the wellspring of my hope is this basic definitional truth. Their power-hungry aggression is growing our movement, right? Their wins in the abortion case, in the coach imposing prayer on other people's children case, in the case of Maine taxpayers funding religious indoctrination, all those happened last term, in the 303 creative case that we were just talking about, right? Their wins swell our ranks. They're creating a feedback loop because of the why. The whole reason for this crusade in the first place is shifting demographics and their fear of those. So white Christian nationalists are working to privilege the chosen few, and every legislative and legal victory that they notch alienates more people, wakes more people up to the danger, and drives more people away from their movement. Their power-hungry aggression is growing our movement.
Hey, so, that is a hopeful statement, because, you know, sometimes it is hard to find hope here, but I think that's really true, because I was talking to Aaron earlier today, and I was like, well, in light of some of these Supreme Court cases, it's kind of open season on queer people, and like white Christians can kind of fire, you know, women, people with disabilities, anyone they don't like. But now that it is open season, we're hearing about it in the news, and it exposes the ugliness of their movement in a way that I do think, you know, is the backlash to the backlash.
Right.
It is. And look, their ideas are wildly unpopular, right? Like, remember the Leonard Leo quote that I gave you earlier? They're trying to capture these anti-democratic mechanisms because they cannot sell people on their ideas. They have to impose them by force. They are crusading because we are working to meet those unmet promises in the American Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution, right? The self-evident truth that all are equal, that we the people means all the people. And previous generations have failed to realize those aspirations. But as we continue to march toward that progress, the Christian nationalists are fighting ever harder against it. And you're right, they're not going to go gently. They're going to rage against the dying of their privilege. But really, in the end, we are going to win, because they are fighting only for themselves. And where they are selfish, we are selfless. They want supremacy. Mm. We want equality. And I believe that is why, in the end, we will triumph. And it's not because our principle is inherently better than theirs, though it most certainly is. Let me just be very clear about that. But because, I mean, the math is on our side. We have the numbers, and that's what they are fighting. That is what they are raging against. And you can fight City Hall, but you can't fight math. So I have a lot of hope.
I absolutely love all of that. I love every single thing that we talked about. Like, I've learned so much, and I think that this is great, and I love ending on a positive note, so folks don't have to wallow in despair at the current situation in our country. But Andrew, tell us how do we find you? Where do we find you on socials? How do we know what you're up to?
Well, Aaron, thank you for asking. I'm Andrew L. Seidel, S-E-I-D-E-L, on all of the socials. I'm on the TikTok, which I love, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. I don't do Facebook anymore, but I'm there. I've got a website.
It's sort of like, oh, we have to still be there sometimes.
I'm going
to
send you a friend request on Facebook right now.
I have not checked it in months.
The hellscape.
Definitely do it on TikTok or on Instagram. That's where I'm more active these days.
Perfect.
I'm on Threads too, even, y'all.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, we got to get on there.
I see you. Yeah. We actually are on there. Rape is on there.
Great. Oh, we're on it.
We're on this.
There you go.
Excellent.
But I mean, also, I would really encourage people to check out Americans United for Separation of Church and State, AU.org, especially if you are like really wanting to focus in on this fight and where, how can you learn more? You know, our youth fellows are really amazing. And our interns go on to these great, big, amazing things. It's been really cool to see them develop even in the short time that I've been with AU, so definitely check that out.
Oh yeah, we highlight that. Our whole team went to the Americans United Summit, and you are a good, like, they are the place to go if you are interested in these issues. Great educational resources, professional opportunities, so definitely check them out. They are on the cutting edge of it all.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much, Andrew. We really loved having you.
Yeah, Andrew, this was so great. Thank you so much.
It was a lot of fun. It really was. I want to do it again.
Thanks for tuning in to On God's Campus, Voices from the Queer Underground. I'm your narrator, Chloe, alongside co-host Paul Carlo Southwick and Aaron Green. This podcast is a product of the Religious Exemption Accountability Project and is produced by Crystal Cheatham from Our Bible App. Listen next time as On God's Campus examines the lessons history has to teach us about where predominantly white Christian educational institutions and the political machines backing them are taking the country now.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is encouraging people to talk it out in therapy. By talking or texting with a supportive, licensed therapist at Talkspace, you'll gain insights, discover truths, and experience breakthroughs that will improve how you live and how you feel. With Talkspace, just answer a few questions online, and you'll be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, whenever you feel most at ease. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members only pay a $25 copay or less. No insurance? No problem. If you want to make progress toward a mentally healthier place, Talkspace is here for you. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.